If you have your own story of being in a cult or a high control group,
or if you've had experience with manipulation or abuse of power that you'd like to share,
leave us a message on our hotline number at 347-86-TRUST.
That's 347-868-7878.
Or shoot us an email at trustmepod@gmail.com.
Trust me.
Dude, you trust me.
Trust me. I'm like a smart person.
Yeah, I've never lied to you. I never have lied to you.
If you think that one person has all the answers,
don't!
Welcome to Trust Me, the podcast about cults, extreme belief, and manipulation from two trash talkers who've actually experienced it. I am Lola Blanc.
And I'm Megan Elizabeth.
And today, our guest is Cheryl Nichols. She is a filmmaker, and she is the subject of Freeform's new docuseries, Keep This Between Us. She'll share how her high school teacher groomed her when she was 16, isolating her from those closest to her, creating an environment of secrecy, and slowly testing the waters with emails that grew more sexual in nature until they began a relationship.
We'll also have a conversation about the societal expectations of teenage girls, the patriarchal culture where she grew up in Texas, how passing the trash keeps predators at schools from facing consequences, and how Cheryl learned she wasn't the only one.
That's right. I really like her. I mean, she's in your group of friends, as we discovered later.
Yeah, I didn't even realize that it was, yeah, it's, I know her. So took us till the end of the interview for me to figure that out. But she's freaking great.
Yeah, super, super cool. Before we dive in with her, I would love to know, Megan, what is their cultiest thing that's happened to you this week?
Oh, this comes out of a Canadian Bible camp, which usually you don't hear much out of those. But some man started working there and uploaded a video of himself to YouTube being like, I just gave one of the best exorcisms of my life. The boy was twitching and bleeding and finally free of his demon. And everyone was like,
oh, my God.
No, you just tortured him.
Oh.
Yeah.
Did he get in trouble?
Yes. He got fired and the police are looking into him. But his response is, they said to me, we can't have you casting out demons. We can't have you performing miracles. That messes with the business we're running here. And it's like, no, nobody's telling you you can't perform miracles, but you can't just beat people and tell them that you're casting out demons. You know what I mean?
I mean, I'm telling him he can't perform miracles, to be clear. He can't perform miracles, I'm pretty sure.
If he can perform a miracle, I would love him to. But this bullshit, I'm okay with.
I just want to briefly mention, because the whole angle on this is about not talking too much about the person. His name rhymes with Schmandrew Schmate.
Okay.
Do you know who I'm referring to?
I do.
Really in the news a lot this week, and it is a really fascinating phenomenon that's come up quite a bit. His whole tactic is to try to offend people as much as possible and try to be as over the top as possible to get more engagement. It does work, and like people being offended by his objectively incredibly offensive statements and behavior. I mean, he's beaten women, whatever. He's like a terrible person.
Yes.
He's on the run from the law in like two different countries. But our outrage at him has given him more and more and more of a platform, which is just something that I think is super interesting. Like, we should be outraged at people like him, but at what point are we actually contributing to making them these like large figures in the culture?
Yeah, it's the same shit as school shooters. We're like, stop doing that. We're going to put you on the cover of Rolling Stone. It's crazy.
And politicians too. I mean, that's a lesson we obviously learned in the past few years, is that like, even if what you're getting is a lot more hate from a particular group, the point is to just get people to watch.
Right.
The more you get people to watch, the more, just like the bigger you become, the more power and influence and the more of a platform that you have. So where is that line between calling people out who are horrible and don't deserve to, you know, have a lot of people listening to them, and actually just ignoring them and not like increasing their power? I don't know.
It's bizarre. It's very strange. I'm interested to see what happens with him after getting canceled and if it'll matter and whatever, because,
well, I'm more interested in his criminal charges.
I mean, yeah.
He's like, it's going to keep, he's not going to stop doing, like, he's gotten into legal trouble in multiple places. I suspect that's not going to stop happening. So regardless of the cancellation, I wonder if criminal charges affect someone's standing at all, or but probably not, right?
No, of course not. I mean, did you see The Most Hated Man on the Internet yet?
No, I'm watching that this week. I'm excited.
Yeah, it's really good. But I mean, the more hated he got, the more whatever, the more charges came against him, the more people loved him. But I don't mean canceled by society. I just mean like taken off, canceled from.
Oh, he was removed from platforms. Right, right, right.
Yeah, yeah. So was Andrew. And I mean, what can you do at that point? You just kind of disappear.
Yeah, I wonder. I wonder.
We'll see.
I wonder what weird platforms they'll end up on. And in any case,
let's keep an eye on that one for sure.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And now, shall we talk to Cheryl?
Let's talk to Cheryl.
Okay. Welcome, Cheryl Nichols. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So you have this docuseries that's just come out, Keep This Between Us, on Freeform. I've just been watching it this morning, and it's very upsetting. But it's very intensely personal in a way I feel like I don't see very often in documentaries. And I guess, can you just start us off by telling what made you want to put such an intensely personal, intimate, challenging story out there in the world like this?
Yeah, I think for me, the more personal the story is, the more relatable it is, and the more we sort of can put ourselves in the position of the protagonist. And so when I was originally like thinking about telling the story, it sort of started with the Harvey Weinstein thing and that story kind of coming out, and I immediately related to it. And as the Me Too movement progressed, something that was missing was not only this kind of phenomenon that I knew about, which was this widespread problem of teacher-student sexual relationships, but also a more intimate portrait of what it is like to be groomed and to be abused and to go through these experiences. And I hadn't ever seen anything that was intimate. And so that's the point that I decided that I wanted to make something that I knew would maybe be challenging and probably a long process, but I thought if I'm going to come out and tell my story, I want to do it in the right way. And that was the way that it seemed was the most right for me.
Yeah, I loved that because there are lots of documentaries about abuse and abusers. And without that like first person perspective, it can be difficult to kind of really connect with what that is and what that feels like. Walk us through this a little bit. Like, you were 16 in Texas, right?
Yes.
What kind of girl were you? What was going on in your life?
I mean, I was very precocious. I was like, you know, those little kids who are ambitious. I kind of knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to be an actor. I wanted to make films. And so I was always performing, and I was a pretty happy kid. And when I went into high school, it was a little complicated for me because I always felt like I was a couple steps behind all of the rest of the girls. I was kind of a late bloomer. And again, like I was really this sort of ambitious kid, and so I was auditioning for things in Dallas. And, you know, I was always like writing plays and doing things like that. So, but I was also a cheerleader and I was very forward. I did a lot of things at the school. I was in student council. You know, I was always in charge of doing whatever homecoming float there was and putting pep rallies together. And so I was very active in that way. And, you know, I was a pretty good student. But the town that I grew up in, Little Elm, is it's a sports focused school. And so though I played sports, especially my freshman year in high school, I never really connected with that world. I was more of an artist and, you know, a little bit of a weirdo. And so when I was in those circles that, you know, cheerleading and, you know, school spirit, I kind of always felt like an outsider. And so I think that was kind of who I was and sort of laid the framework for someone to kind of come in and, you know, be who I wanted them to be and tell me what I wanted to hear.
Yeah, feeling like a late bloomer is something that I kept reading people say.
For sure. I mean, you know, it's weird because I guess I thought there was a particular kind of person, like a person like me, like that was a late bloomer that would be susceptible to, you know, being kind of groomed by somebody like this. But especially in the last few days, I've had so many women reach out to me, a lot of women even from my school who had experienced similar things. And they're coming from all, I mean, it's like, it's literally everybody. And
wow.
What's interesting is, you know, I also have heard, you know, I never really thought about this as deeply. Well, this happened at my school. Oh, we always just made it a joke. Those kinds of things.
Yeah. Yeah.
You never realize like how, you know, well, I did, but you know, I think in general, like society, we didn't realize like how big of a problem it is and what it is, because we assign the child, the teenager, with the responsibility for this. How many times do we hear she knew what she was doing? I mean, I'm still reading that in stupid, the comment sections of things about the show. It's like people want to make this argument that 16-year-old girls are somehow capable of, you know, being these like sirens or seductresses.
And yeah.
I think that's kind of like why this show is so important and why it's kind of striking a chord for a lot of people, because a lot of people have an experience with this, but they haven't really thought about it in terms of like, you know, abuse or grooming.
I was talking to my boyfriend about this recently, actually. I feel like, so as a kid, I spent a lot of time around adults, and I think I got, and around boys, and I got really comfortable with like acting like an adult. And so when I was quite young, I was in relationships with much older people, and there were people who, you know, tried to have inappropriate sexual relationships with me. Stories for another day, but like, I think, you know, you tell yourself when you're that age, well, I'm just really mature. And to the undiscerning eye, it can seem like someone maybe knows themselves or like is an adult in some way. But teenagers are good at acting like adults, but that sometimes, but that does not mean that they actually are.
No. And we have to find a way to unpack this in a way and stop treating teenage girls as like separate cases. Like a teenage girl needs space to be who she is, whether that's immature or mature, or, you know, if she wants to explore her sexuality, whatever a teenage girl wants to do, she needs a safe place to do that, where she doesn't have to be aware of, like, you know, older men trying to take advantage of that,
yeah,
or making some excuse about her being mature. So that's why they were able to take what they wanted from her.
Right.
It's a growth space. And if a teenage girl is mature, that's her right. It doesn't mean that suddenly like the school is a dating app for, you know,
yeah,
older men. It's just not, it's not a dating spot. It's a place where she goes to trust other people to become who she wants to be.
How did you first meet the teacher? Because when you first met him, he was not yet a teacher, right?
No, yeah, he wasn't. His wife at the time was a teacher at the school, but he would come and help us in the theater department. He would help us like do the plays and, you know, give us notes and things like that. So I met both of them when I was 15.
And then he becomes a teacher. So I want to talk about the grooming process. And we were actually just talking about how weirdly, we haven't really defined grooming on this show yet. Like, it's something that is in the cultural lexicon and people talk, but we've never clearly defined it. Do you have a definition that you use, or like kind of a list of what it entails?
Yeah. I mean, I try not to do like a book definition, because I think that, you know, it just depends on the context. But I think generally grooming is a set of behaviors that are used to slowly manipulate another human being into doing what you want them to do.
It can include isolating and creating dependency, gaining trust through secrets and attention and gifts. And this one is the one that I think is really, really important, which is the desensitization to sexual topics and or touch, which I definitely obviously see in your docuseries. So that includes like discussing sexual things, not like it's between us two, but just like in general, like about you and your boyfriend, or what do you think about this sexual act, just in general. You know, that's something that I didn't really have words to articulate, but that is a part of grooming. And also it can include grooming people around the victim by seeming especially charming and helpful and kind. So, that said, can you describe some of the ways in which that process happened with you?
Certainly. It definitely happened in stages. I think the first stage was the befriending stage, in which he sort of brought me in and made me believe that I could trust him. Like, he was a trusted advisor. You know, he would give me books and he would advise me like on my term papers and things like that. And we would spend time, you know, he was very loving and jokey. And so he made me feel like he was an easy person to be around and that I could trust him. He would ask, he would say like, you can talk to me about this stuff. Like, I'm not like those other teachers, or I'm not like your parents. Like, I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to judge you or whatever.
Oh, how like enticing for a kid to, yeah.
Of course, because like I said, you know, the environment that I grew up in was so specific, and it was not like, I didn't feel connected to it. And so he was the opposite. Like, he was kind of a nerd. He was interesting. Like, he liked movies and television and books and all of these things that, you know, I needed exposure to. And so he kind of opened himself up and exposed me to those things. And I think that was the kind of befriending aspect to it. I think then once the email relationship started and he said, you know, hey, why don't we speak privately, he created this space where it was just he and I, which is like the very beginning of the isolation. And it also started to incorporate the bits where, you know, he would try out, you know, sexual themes. You know, he would try things out in the email. Oh, you would never talk sexually to me. Oh, you would never say this to me, would you? To see how I would react, to kind of like test the water.
Right.
And I think that's where the late bloomer thing comes in, because I think there's a certain amount of like innocence that a person has, like a girl has when someone's speaking to her like that. Like, it feels kind of titillating and good, but you don't actually like think it's going to go anywhere. And I think that's where I was at that point. It kind of felt good to sort of speak with a trusted person about these things that I'd been wanting to speak and maybe didn't feel comfortable speaking about with boys my age. But you know, he was putting them out there. And so that started, I think, for me, where I started opening up sexually to him. You know, I was able to start, you know, saying like, oh, maybe I would, you know, or okay, I'll tell you this thing about me and my boyfriend or whatever. And so then he started steering me away from the boy that I was interested in that time and sort of steering me more towards what he would, you know, what he wanted, which is he would say, you know, oh, I'm so, you know, I'm so jealous. If only I were a teenager, then I would kiss you, you know, things like that.
Ugh.
And sort of implanting. Yeah. And, you know, when I was a teenager, those things felt very exciting to me. And I knew that they were probably wrong, but I don't know. It's hard to describe. I didn't totally understand where it would go or what it would mean, you know. I couldn't connect myself to the consequences. And so,
right. Of course.
I think within that, there's a part in the documentary where we talk about these emails that happened during the, you know, the Christmas between 99 and 2000. And I had a very dear friend who's in the documentary, Katie Hall. And we had been friends since I was a kid, like since we were 8. And he essentially in those emails kind of steered me away from her, telling her that she was just jealous of me. She was never going to be as like brilliant and beautiful as me. And she was just jealous of like me and my boyfriend. And he was really pushing me away from her.
Oh.
And he would do the same thing about my mother. He would say the same thing about my mom.
Wow. So
basically what he did is like what I think is probably like a third stage, which is he isolated me from my support group.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Once that was the case, like he could kind of implant anything into my mind that he wanted to. And he had given me Lolita over Thanksgiving, I think. And so I had already read it. And so it was something we talked about. And so there was like we started talking on these like private chats they were called ICQ back then, but they were kind of like,
oh yeah,
AOL Instant Messenger.
I remember ICQ.
Yeah. It was like our old way of texting. Right. And,
yeah.
And so we were essentially texting. And so we started communicating in this way. And, you know, he would just start, you know, we just started talking about those things and it became more and more sexual and it became more and more obvious that we were going to have a kiss. And so once I was isolated and once I didn't have a support system anymore. I didn't have anybody to bounce all of this stuff off of. So I was in the hall one day and he handed me this poem. He was a writer And he handed me this poem, and this poem was, we featured in the documentary a little bit, but it was called Frustration. It starts, "The desk is a wide wooden bunker unknown." And it's about this desire he had for something that was beyond this impenetrable desk.
Blech.
And I knew it was about me.
Yeah.
And I immediately became like jelly, you know, like I had never felt this way for somebody before. And they, you know, it had never been reciprocated, and it felt so romantic, and it felt like a book, and it felt like it was meant to be. And so very shortly after that, I was at his house and he kissed me. And that was sort of the last thing. Like, who was I going to tell? Where was I going to go? I didn't have anybody to tell me this was weird or whatever. I only had him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, then it just, then the story just kind of, you know, it snowballs from that.
He had you talking anonymously, or he was like, how was he emailing with you? Or was he scared that, I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, you know, this is 1999. So I think he had a pretty good idea about what needed to, you know, like in what the first email second email he sends me, it said, you know, you want to change your name from Cheryl Nichols to something else.
Right.
And so I did. And so there was an idea that you wanted to be, you know, writing from a different name. But, and so we had these code names, and one of the code, and we also had these code names that were our nicknames. Like, I called him Monkey and he called me Pony, which is why the show used to be called Dear Pony, because it was the thing that he called me. And yeah, so I mean, there was like, we were just speaking over email, you know, we were saying those words, but it was obvious that it was us. Like, if anybody had seen them, I think that they probably could have figured out pretty quickly, you know, who it was.
Yeah.
Maybe it was more just him like having you identify as someone else, you know, like I'm not me.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that it was like a universe that we could both exist in, you know, that wasn't the universe with like the rules and like, you know,
yeah,
morals and ethics, like
boring old stuff like that.
Not that I have either one of those things now, but
same.
He was still married through this whole period, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I mean, I imagine this all feels very exciting and fun, and like you're kind of special in the moment, right?
Yeah, I was torn. I mean, I knew I was hurting. I felt like, you know, I'm hurting her. Like, she was my teacher. I loved her very much. But the story between he and I was, you know, he would say things like, people love more than one person in their life. You know, people can love more than one person. Like, this is complicated. I hate it too. He would give up some of his, you know, it seemed like he was conceding a little bit, that he was saying like, you know, I know that this is wrong and we're guilty, but I just can't help myself. And like, that's some ultimate validation, that especially as a teenager who's, you know, I had never had sex. I'd not messed around with anybody, really. You know, I would never let boys do anything to me. Like, I'd only kissed like two guys. And so I did never have that kind of validation, and it felt really good. And so I was in conflict for sure.
Right.
I didn't think that it was okay or right. And I didn't just feel like it was exciting. Like, and I think that's important, because I think that's part of this narrative of like, oh, girls know what they're doing. You know, teenage girl, you know,
yeah.
Like, we treat them like they're viruses. And it's like, you know, it's more complicated than that, because our little brains aren't fully developed. You know, we're just experiencing the world as it comes at us.
Totally. I remember when I was 17, there was a much older man who kissed me, and it was like someone my family knew. And I definitely felt like it was exciting, and I felt special when I would get attention from an older man, because I felt like it was validating my maturity in some way. Mm-hmm. Like I perceived myself as someone who is like more intelligent or something. So like attention from an older man would almost be like, ah, yes, that is what I am. You know, of course, in retrospect, it's like, oh my God, that is, well, you know,
it puts you above the criticism in a way, right? Like something you seek in my, this is just my perspective. I don't want to speak too generally, but I think something that I was seeking was like being beyond reproach, because I felt like there were so many opportunities for me to be wrong or a slut or a whore or, you know, a prude. Like I could be any of those things that they attach to you as a kid, like as a teenager, are things that you don't want to be and you're trying to avoid, you know? So if somebody tells you that you're above the fray, like you're intelligent, you're more this, you're more that, then you can kind of live above those stupid words that other people assign you. Because it was so scary to me to be a slut. You know, it was like the worst thing that I could possibly be. Now I'm like, hell yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Like sluts tonight. But like I didn't have that kind of role model. Like I didn't feel like I could be experimental or free with my sexuality. So there was just like this open wound that a person could just kind of pour salt on. And that was him, you know?
Yeah. And what teenager, by the way, does not have an open wound of some kind? Like you're still figuring out who you are. Everyone is insecure at that age. If somebody wants to manipulate you, like they're probably going to be able to find a way to do it.
It is so freaking hard to be a teenager. Like it is so hard. Like you have all these chemical things happening to you. You've got all these adults that are suddenly having an opinion about who you are. You've got to deal with all the kids around you having an opinion of who you are while you're trying to figure out who you are. It's insane. Like I just remember being so stressed out sometimes. Like I would stay up until 3 o'clock in the morning, even though I had just to be by myself, because I had, and even though I had to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, like I didn't ever feel like there was a space where I could exist. And that was part of why I just wanted to like get out. Like I just wanted to get out of Little Elm. I just wanted to get out of my house, because I just felt like I owed myself out to everybody. And I think a lot of teenagers, even if they're not super involved with the school, I think that a lot of teenagers feel like that. I think that they feel like they owe other people themselves. And then when somebody comes into your life and, you know, they're an authority figure and they can, in a way validate you in that way that you're seeking validation, it's like, it's so easy to just take it from them. It feels so good.
Yeah. Well, and men, I mean, we are, you know, certainly all of us at least grew up believing that men are who you respect. You listen to men. Men know what's best for you, you know?
Yeah. Most of the pastors are, you know, we're, mm-hmm. 'cause I'm from Texas, is very, you know, religious state. Most of the pastors, superintendents, most of the school administration, most of the administration are men. And then most of the coaches are men, all except for one of my basketball coaches were men. Like men telling you what to do all the time. Men deciding, like, I remember one time, one of my basketball coaches, I was like on my period and I was really heavy and I was like still cramping and I just did not want to sprint. And I was like, hey man, like I need to sit down. I can't sprint. And he told me to just like shove a tampon up there and that running would make the cramps better. And I was
God.
It's very basic things like that, that don't seem like a big deal, but like they train us to be a certain way in our life. They train us to like, this is how you're going to interact with men for the rest of your life. This is how you need to interact from society. Like in a way, like just shove a tampon up there and get over it is like a metaphor for like how we're
totally
to experience the rest of our lives. And
yeah.
You know, I mean, I think that starts when you're a teenager and you're starting to come into that woman's body for the first time. And people are starting to recognize you like that. So they think that they can talk to you and they can own you that way. And like, that was probably a bigger part of the impetus for making this documentary, is because I got so sick of having this conversation with people. Like I got so sick of being like, I know that you think that things are equal, but they're not. And this is why it actually starts back here when we're teenagers. I had this experience. I know a lot of other girls who had this experience. And when they move through their daily lives, they carry this experience with them, and this is how they interact with the rest of the world. And so that was also part of the, of wanting to do the intimate story, is because I knew that I was, that those threads were going to be pulled when I was going through like exposing this and like going and talking to people who I knew growing up. I knew that we were going to be able to see like how it affects people in their daily lives, how it affects women in their daily lives. And that was what was most important to me.
So you and the teacher had a relationship for a number of years, and people can watch the doc to kind of see how exactly that unfolded and changed over time. The thing I would like to know is, when and how did the switch happen for you from thinking it was a somewhat normal relationship to realizing it was something much worse than that?
I think when he and I broke up, there was a couple of years of, we were still in kind of light communication, but there were a couple of years of me starting to wonder, like, that felt really bad. You know, I have a lot of shame about that time in my life, but I was a willing participant. So, you know, I have to take some responsibility for this. I wasn't in therapy yet. And then in 2007, I found out that there was another person that he did this to at Little Elm. And that is when I was able to realize that I was able to see myself outside of myself, because I was able to see that person and what he had done to them. And I saw it. When I knew that it had happened to that person, when I found out that it happened to that person, I could see the grooming.
Yeah.
That's, I think, the first time that I was able to start applying it to myself.
Just like giving yourself self-compassion because you saw yourself differently.
Yeah. And I don't know that I fully grasped it at that point. I mean, I think I was 25, so, or 24. So I don't think I totally understood it. I think I still wanted to take a lot of the responsibility, because I'd been told my whole life that, you know, I was responsible. And there are so many people who still hold me responsible. You know, it's not like that sentiment is gone, you know, now that it's 2022, like a lot of people would still hold me responsible, or, you know, so it took a long time after that of really untethering it and therapy and being reminded constantly, and also just telling some people the story and having people be like, oh my God, I cannot believe that happened to you. Wow, that happened at my school. You know, just things like that. Like it took a long time for me to not normalize it.
Right.
And see it as what it was.
Isn't it funny how something can happen and you're like, yeah, it was whatever. It was normal. And then you say it out loud to someone else and their faces go white and you're like, oh, is that not? Oh.
Well, I didn't tell people for a long time because I was ashamed. And I was, you know, I was in LA. I was trying to be an actor and a filmmaker. And I really didn't want this following me around. I used to be terrified that if I ever like got on a show or was able to like get a movie out or something, that this would like come out in the press and then destroy me, you know?
Oh, that makes me so sad.
I was worried about that for like probably 7 or 8 years. I would just like, I was afraid to kind of reach my potential or become myself. And I think there was a lot of like self-destructive behaviors that kind of came out of that, because even though I had spent my entire life like trying to do this, you know, and wanting to like move to New York or LA and like pursue my dream, there was a big part of me that felt like I didn't deserve it, because if I did achieve something, that, you know, it would follow me around and it would destroy me. And what I didn't know is that it was just quietly destroying me, you know.
Part of the reason for the conception of this podcast is because of a cult experience that my mother and I had. And I remember she was like afraid to pursue her dreams for years because she was so afraid that it would like somehow come out and destroy. And he actually made some explicit threats. So that's kind of a different thing. But it is amazing how like the victims in a situation can think that somehow having been a victim of abuse is going to be the thing that ruins your career.
Yes. And I watched him, you know, find a new partner, buy a house, get a PhD, buy another house, move to a place, become a professor, you know, like write books. Like I watched him do all of these things. and I was completely self-destructive. I was in like a real spiral for many, many, many years, you know, and just beating the living shit out of myself. And, you know, I finally got it together. And I, like I said, like I went through years of therapy. I got on medication. I pulled myself out of it, but it took a long time. And I think that maybe people don't understand why, you know, I think maybe people don't understand like why I went through all of this and why it was so hard. And so much of it is because of the way that I felt that people would see me. And so that's like part of the thing that I'm really hoping can shift, is that I'm hoping that we can create a space where people can come forward and talk about this and not have this giant victim stain attached to them, that they feel like they can talk about their experience and that they can move through it and that they don't have to walk around with that letter on their chest.
Yeah. It doesn't have to define your career. It doesn't have to define who you are as an artist or what you do with the rest of your life.
Or if you're a good or bad person.
Yeah.
Even putting this documentary out, I was like, oh God, man, like my movie's coming out. This documentary is coming out like a month later. Like, what am I doing? Am I ruining my career? And then I was like, no, because the point is that I am not going to allow myself to be deterred from speaking out and also from doing the thing that I want to do, because that was the whole reason that I didn't do it in the first place. It's important to me to do both things and to be all the things, to like main, you know, I'm not allowing people to like tell me not to have a sense of humor about it or like whatever. Like, I am who I am. I'm out there, and like, you know, we need to be able to speak about this openly, and then we need to be able to get on with our damn lives and make our movies or be secretaries or, you know, freaking be doctors or, you know, just be at home. Like, we just need to be able to be who we want to be.
There was the girl that you spoke to who said it happened to her also. And then he was fired also for another incident. Was that what it was?
At another school.
At another school. Okay. Yeah. So this is a thing this man is doing.
Yeah. I think the statistic is a teacher is passed to three schools before they are convicted of doing this. So
wow. I
think that's the statistic.
Which is called passing the trash, as you guys mentioned in the doc.
Which is exactly it. Passing the trash is the term for that, which is when a school, you know, discovers that a teacher has behaved inappropriately, and rather than report them, they keep it quiet, and the teacher usually resigns and they pass them on to another school. And unbeknownst to the other school, they hire the teacher. That's the part of it that I knew, which is that, you know, I know that this happens. But experiencing it, like speaking to the other people that this happened to, is a completely different thing, because there's a personal aspect of it that you feel betrayed, that I felt betrayed on a different level. Not like I'd already felt betrayed by him, but I suddenly felt exposed, because I felt stupid. Like, I felt duped. I felt like the same things that worked on me worked for two other people and God knows how many others, right? Like, that there was a pattern that I was susceptible to, and that made me feel really stupid. And it made me feel like my secrets were exposed. And it made me feel like I was standing naked with a bunch of other people. And I think that's the first thing to get over.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say that's how a lot of people explain when they realize they're in a cult, which is what we usually talk about. So,
which is why I felt like this was the most appropriate podcast for me to be on, because I often described what I experienced as like a cult-like experience. You know, there was a harem essentially around him of, you know, girls, and a few boys, but not many, that were, you know, that loved him, and his outreach, like the circle that he created around himself, and the fact that like he could do no wrong, and like he giving us all music and books and things like that. He was creating this like culture around himself, you know, that always seemed very cult like. And also just the things that he would say to me. Sometimes he would say things like, you know, God has a plan. Oh, no. No, stuff like that, that felt, I don't know, spiritual to me in a way that I was kind of craving at that point in my life. And yeah.
He's like very Willy Wonka-ish or something.
Well, we should call him Willy Wonka. Yes. That's great. Oh, I'm going to call him Willy Wonka from now on. Oh, that's amazing. Where have you been for this whole process? It's amazing. Yeah, he is. But he's like the Johnny Depp Willy Wonka, you know, the one
totally.
Where like, really, we need another.
Yeah. Yeah.
Willy Wonka? Like, what's wrong with Gene Wilder?
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
The Johnny Depp Willy Wonka is like the biggest insult I can think of.
I know. I mean, I'm sorry, Disney. I love you. Like, come on.
The original is better. We got to be honest.
My heart belongs to Gene Wilder. Sorry.
Always. I get in trouble for everything all of the time. Like, I'll, you know, pay, like, take an extra breadstick from the buffet and, like, the police sirens start going off and people are like, what are you doing? And I just don't understand how there's this really big problem that no one gives a fuck about. It's like, sure, yeah, we'll just pass the trash. What is happening?
I think there's a lot of levels to it. I think one of the levels is just like the basic people just covering their ass. You know what I mean? These school systems are like their own little political systems. And so I think that there's a lot of protection that goes on that has to do with like, you know, funds or support or jobs, things that you receive that you need. And you can't have this dirty little stain, you know, following you around. And I think that's part of it. I'm almost sure that that's what happened in my school. You know, why it was like, you might hear rumors, but as long as it's not provable, then like, let's move on because we've got bigger fish to fry kind of a thing.
Right.
I definitely think that that's what happened to me. I don't think that there's like a evil overlord who's like, ho, 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 molest the girls, you know?
Yeah.
I definitely think that there's an aspect of this, which is like, if it's not something that we can prove, if there's not some, you know, big dog behind it, then like, let's just let it go. I think that's part of it. I also think the other part of it is that there truly is this cultural thing. And I'm seeing it in the comments. Like, I'm stupid. I'm going to stop reading them because it's going to fry my brain.
Yeah.
But, and like, I don't care what people think. You know what I mean? Like, I really am almost 40 years old. Like, I don't care.
But it's good. Yeah. You know, yeah.
Like, no, I really don't give a shit with like Bob 425 thinks about me, you know, what happened to me in high school. But what I am seeing is there, you know, just generally is that there is like a cultural thing that happens where people want to assign the blame to teenage girls. Like they want to believe that somehow they're culpable or that they're even capable of like making this thing happen. And what we're not doing is looking like, okay, sure, whatever. Let's say you believe that about the teenage girl, but like, let's look at the guy, right?
The adult.
Right. This is the, like, let's look at the perpetrator. This is the man who is deciding that for some reason a 16-year-old girl is an appropriate partner for him. Like, let's look at that basic bullshit. And I think that that's something that people are kind of forgetting when they're saying these things. So I think that's the other bit about this is for some reason we focus on the desires of these teenage girls and their ability to seduce rather than the perpetrator and their ability to groom.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know?
Right.
I really don't know why. I've spent 5 years on this project. I've done a lot of research and I really don't understand that. I mean, I have ideas and I have like my own, you know, feelings about the patriarchy and misogyny and stuff, but I don't know. I don't know.
It feels like that's the same thing I learned in church growing up, which is that like, well, if you reveal your midriff or too much of your thigh, the boys literally physically cannot help themselves. And therefore, it's you who's tempting them and you are the problem versus like, well, I'm pretty sure like a boy could maybe not. He could like literally physically stop himself from doing something.
100%. We are always to blame. Keep your legs closed. All of that crap. Like, blue balls, you know, I mean,
blue balls, don't fucking get me started on blue balls. That shit fucked me up for so many years.
Yeah, and it starts when we're like little girls, you know, we're like groomed from the time we're babies,
yeah,
to believe these things and to like be pleasing. And
yeah,
and that's in all kinds, that's in all cultures. It's not just like Southern Christian culture. It's like, it, you know, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but there is something to say. I'm Midwestern with like a very religious, I mean, we're literally taught like you worship men, you do what they say. They're the head of the household, you whatever, whatever, whatever. Like that was just normalized to me completely. So yeah.
Yeah. And crazy. It's, you know, I think that gender stuff, like, I think it is sick. Like, I think that the way that we like separate the boys and the girls at a young age and like, you know, just like immediately sort of put these, this like gender thing on them and then like have them behave this way. Like I went to school with a lot of people who are non-binary now, like they have found themselves, and growing up in that environment was really toxic for them because there is no space if you do not fit in one of those categories. And this was like, I think also, I think part of my experience is that, you know, I didn't feel like I fit into any sort of like gender roles in that way. And so I think when somebody was kind of validating me in the ways that I wanted to be seen, it was like easy for me to be manipulated.
In the series, you also talked to other girls who've had this experience and are seeking justice. And I mean, how common is this?
I mean, I would say it probably happens at every single school, every single high school within like a 3-year. That would be my guess if I were just throwing out a fake statistic. I would guess that this happens in probably every school once every 5 years.
Mm.
You know, it's an insidious problem. I rarely speak to anybody or tell them the story and they don't say, oh, yeah, I that happened in my school. It just, I almost never have an experience like that. And if I do, it's because they usually don't know. And they come back to me a few months later and they were like, oh my God, I was like, one of our producers was like, she went back to her hometown and was telling them this project she was working on. They were like, yeah, that happened at our school. Didn't you know that? And she was like, holy shit. Like, had no idea.
Wow. Well, I was a fucking homeschooled nerd, so it didn't happen at my school, but.
Are you sure?
You're like,
no, yeah, obviously this is, but it's not public schools. It's not private schools. It's everywhere. You know, it's like every single school in the United States, every single kind of school, you know, every demographic, like it happens everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Did it happen at anywhere for you, Megan? Do you have any stories like this?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, I just remember the basketball coach and our math teacher, everybody being like, they're cute. And just them, I just remember them like flirting and me always being like, hee, hee, hee. And then looking back, it's like, what the fuck were they doing? Why were they flirting with a 15 and 16 year old? And I'm sure they did something with someone. I'm sure of it.
Imagine like being like a 29, 30 year old person. I don't know how old you guys are. And being like, oh, there, look at this cute 16 year old that looks like appealing to me. Or like, I want to have like a conversation with in my adult like life. Like I wouldn't want to extend that into my adult life where I'm doing things that I want to do. I just don't get it.
It's not normal. For no, sure.
It's not normal, but it's
common, but it's not.
It's common,
but it's not normal. Yeah.
Yeah. It is not. What? How about this? It's not okay.
No,
it's definitely not. You know, and I partially raised a teenager and I just kept, and he was 16, 17, 18 when I was, you know, beginning this documentary. And I was just like, it's my partner's son. And I just kept looking at him and being like, oh my God, like this is the age that I was. And this is totally crazy.
Perspective is so great. Yeah.
But can I bring up a really depressing statistic that I recently tweeted though? There was a
sure.
And we can wrap this up in a minute. But there was that like there were all those OkCupid studies pulling data from dating apps and based on conversations and the, you know, like not self-reporting or anything, but literally like, who are they matching with? Who are they having conversations with? For women, as they get older throughout their lifespan being on a dating app,
oh my God,
their preferences get a little bit older, and it's usually within a 2 to 3 window of their year. For men, at least this was, what, 5 years ago or something? At least 5 years ago, for men, as they get older, their preferences literally never change, and they stay in the range of 18 to 22 until they're like 59.
Woo!
Or actually, a lot of them are like literally 19. It's like 45. Number one choice is 19-year-old, 20-year-old. It's literally like that. It's forever, and I find it incredibly like depressing and creepy and gross.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I have a bunch of ideas about it. I think like we have culturally held up youth as the thing that is sexy and beautiful. We have like this idea that I've heard so many fucking douchebag men bring up, which is like, well, evolutionarily, like women are the most fertile. This is just evolution. I think that that is certainly not the whole story. I think a lot of it is about porn. I think a lot of it is about movies and what is represented as sexual and the way that women are sexualized. But I don't know, you know?
Well, I can state for probably a fact I was much more fun to date when I was 19 than I am now. So I can understand the pull to just experience maybe an easier type of person.
Well, someone who doesn't challenge you,
yeah,
because they don't know themselves that well yet. I mean, I sure think that's a big part of it too.
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah. So I think that's the thing with the teenagers. I think that there is an element of this which is like, this is an easier person to date. Like, this isn't a person who's going to challenge me. And I think that's because part of that is like a societal expectation that young women and girls be easy.
Yeah.
That they be, you know, that they be dateable, that they be fun, that they be loose, that they be sweet, that, you know, that,
yeah,
that whole keep sweet thing, right? It's like,
mm-hmm.
And then as we get older, we care less and less about that. And so we find ourselves, we become more of ourselves.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, it becomes a little bit harder to date, but I mean, so dating is hard. Like being in a relationship is hard. It's difficult. I don't think that these people are looking for like real relationships. They're looking for something that they can control, you know?
Right, right.
And that was what became clear for me in my relationship with the teacher, is that it was more and more clear that he just wanted to control me. He wouldn't let me drink coffee because he didn't believe in drinking coffee. I couldn't drink alcohol. I had to like the same things that he liked. And if I didn't, they were stupid. Like there were all of these things, these ways that he groomed me when I was a teenager. And then when I stopped being those things for him, I became less attractive to him. And then he set his sights on somebody else. And so I think I definitely lived that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I've heard dudes be like, women in their 30s, they all want kids. They all want to like, hold me down, hold me back, and whatever. There's so many.
Yeah. But like, what if we actually taught girls when they're younger? And I think that they are changing, but what if we actually taught them to be honest with themselves about what they really want and what they want to do in the world and who they
yeah.
want to be? And they were more individualized in that way. And their livelihood didn't depend on them being something for society or for a man. Like
yeah.
they didn't, you know, how many times, like, I can't remember how many times, like in my late 20s, people were asking me when I was going to get married and have kids. And I was like, this is not what I'm doing with my life right now. Like, and I think there's just so much expectation to not just be cute and sweet and put in the pocket, but like to also behave like a woman. And there's all of this backlash to Me Too now. You know, there's the Andrew Tate, there's the, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. all the Proud Boys situation, all of that stuff that's just reinforcing this idea that like women should be women. And what that actually means is that, you know, girls should be women.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I think that's the thing for me that is the most damaging. What I'm really trying to fight against right now is that we also deserve our individual freedom, and girls are people.
Yeah.
I love that.
I love that too. Thank you so much for talking to us and having this conversation.
This was so fun. Thanks for letting me yap on about stuff.
It's so important. Thank you.
I agree.
Yeah. Oh my God. It makes me really angry, but really hopeful too. And yeah, I hope everybody watches this, especially young girls.
That's it's okay to be angry. It's what they call, it's the righteous anger, right? We can still live our lives. We don't have to carry it around with us all the time.
Totally.
True.
Keep This Between Us, guys. It's on Freeform. It's available now. And Cheryl, do you want to talk about your movie also? What is your movie?
Oh, yeah. My movie is called Doula. I direct it. It's written by Aaron Shiver, and it stars Troy Belisario and Will Greenberg. And Aaron Shiver is produced by Chris Pine and Gottler. And it's on...
Oh, my gosh. Ray, I know why... I think I recognize you. Okay, go on. And, I think we have a friend in common. Okay.
Yeah. And then, it's a Universal distributed it, and it you can find it on like iTunes and Amazon and all of that stuff.
Amazing. I want to watch it. And also, I Keep This Between Us is available on Freeform and Hulu. Can't forget Hulu. Okay, awesome.
Love it.
Do you have social media that where people can find you?
Yeah, I'm Cheryl Pickles.
I knew you were Cheryl Pickles.
Yes. We must know similar people.
I'm friends with like Caitlin, who used to date Brendan.
Caitlin's one of my best friends.
I know. Yeah, Caitlin is one of my dearest friends. Oh, I was like, why are you so familiar looking? That's so funny.
Oh my god, Megan. Oh my god, yes. That makes so much sense. I cannot wait to call Caitlin. Tell her.
This is so ridiculous. I'll text her too. It's amazing. So nice to finally meet you again.
Yeah, you too. Yeah,
amazing. Yeah, it'll be out soon. So hell yeah.
Awesome. Hell yeah, indeed.
Hell yeah.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, you guys.
All right, Megan. Well, I already asked you if at your schools there was any of that stuff going on, but I guess I'm curious, did you have any age inappropriate relations at any point in your life?
I never like acted on. I had teachers that would kind of be flirty, but nothing that was consummated.
I mean, as I mentioned, I would say like for whatever reason, for whatever weird fucking daddy issues I have, like I was very, I felt the need to be validated by older men for quite a long time. And into my 20s, I dated some much older men. And I say dated, I mean, as an adult, I dated people who were much older than me. But also when I was younger, there were inappropriate men, you know, approaching me and in a couple of cases, you know, kissing me. And it's really interesting to look back on now because, you know, at the time you really, at least, I don't know, I can't speak to anyone else. But at the time I was like, ooh, this is wrong. This is exciting. And then over time it's like, wait, that was gross and creepy and inappropriate. That man was like 35.
I know.
There was one man whose name people would recognize who would... was like circling me literally like the 2 weeks before I turned 18. Ugh. I was working at Jamba Juice and he was like coming in and leaving tips and wanted to hang out. And the week that I turned 18, he like took me out and was the first person that I kissed as an 18-year-old. Which I wasn't into it for different reasons at the time because I felt objectified. Mm. But I think if he had lavished attention on me in, you know, a grooming sort of way, I would have probably continued to go for it because I just like, you know, it, whatever, it appealed to that insecurity in me that is easy to manipulate in younger people.
Right.
But yeah, so now looking back on it, I'm like, oh, interesting. All of that stuff that I thought was so normal at the time. And yeah. Turns out it's not. I mean, like we said, it is common, but it's not cool. You said it's not okay.
Yeah. Like I was very grossed out by a person like a year older than me.
Really?
I don't know. Yeah, I was like gross. Like there was nothing. I was very, even now, like my boyfriend's still like 2 years younger than me.
Jack is a year and a half younger than me. And it's like the first time that's ever happened.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, this is the first time I've ever dated somebody younger, but I've definitely never dated anybody older. I was always just like my age. I don't know.
My first boyfriend was 20 years older than me. My first long-term boyfriend.
Wow.
Yeah. And my second long-term boyfriend was 16 years older than me. So
yeah, none of that. for me.
Those were complicated situations. I don't think those were predatory in the way that Cheryl's story is predatory, but
yeah, they're all different, huh?
It turns out that life is nuanced and complicated.
It surely is. Well, speaking of nuance.
Oh my God. I don't know. What is it? Well, who are we?
Who are we? Thank you guys so much for joining us for another week. We cannot wait to talk to you here again next time. And as always, remember to follow your gut, watch out for red flags,
and never, ever
trust me. Bye.
Bye. Trust Me is produced by Kirsten Woodward, Gabby Rapp, and Steve Delamater.
With special thanks to Stacey Para.
And our theme song was composed by Holly Amber Church.
You can find us on Instagram at Trust Me Podcast, Twitter at Trust Me Cult Pod, or on TikTok at Trust Me Cult Podcast.
I'm Ula Lola on Instagram and Ola Lola on Twitter.
And I am Megan Elizabeth 11 on Instagram and Babraham Hicks on Twitter.
Remember to rate and review and spread the word.